A couple of years ago on Memorial Day, I was biking in Brentwood, where I grew up. And I grew up not very far from the Veterans Cemetery. And I've done some services there, but when I've got my, I'm doing a service hat on and I'm focused, you don't really see everything that there is because you're connected with the family. But I biked through there and saw all the flags that had been placed on all of the, both the vertical headstones and the ground. I looked at the names, and I was impressed by a couple of things. We integrated our cemeteries much earlier than we integrated our society. That you saw names that were Jewish and German and Polish and Italian, names that were ethnic and Asian and all different kinds of people in the dust. And it raises a couple of questions. Of course, why can't we get together while we're still alive? Why do the artificial accidents of birth, of ethnicity, of names, of colors, of melanin content, why does it have to wait till death, till we understand that we are of common dust and of common spirit, united together? The other thing that was triggered in biking through the cemetery was I remembered when I was a child growing up, much as Ron, though I'd like to think a few years later, but not many, and that cemetery and that Veterans Administration was there, and there were survivors of the Spanish-American War, and most of the people who were hanging around were from World War I and some from World War II. Many had been injured, even, we'd say handicapped today, but mutilated, given the kind of plastic surgery that did not exist and the medical care that they did not receive. And I remember as a child averting my eyes from these people who had lost limbs and had very crude prostheses. This was in the very early 50s. And averting my eyes from those who had been emotionally damaged as well, who hung out, I know this is hard to believe, at the nickel beer bars along San Vicente Boulevard, and the ones who were clearly damaged, both physically and emotionally. And again, it was hard to look at. It was scary for a kid to see somebody who wasn't normal in the way that kids idealize adults, and to see what could happen to the survivors in war. Too much of the time, we avert our eyes and we avert our hearts from looking at the costs, the real human costs of war. Now, I know it's fashionable for clergy to get on high horse at Christmas time and for Christians to say, let's put the Christ back in Christmas because it drifts off into a commercial world. Put the Chah back in Hanukkah, and it's not Chanukah or Hanukkah, it's Hanukkah, like the Scotch Loch Lomond. But we ought to put the memory back into Memorial Day. It isn't just about a 500-mile race and picnics. It isn't simply a patriotic holiday. That's July 4th is good for patriotism. This is a time for memory. And mourning our losses is about memory. It's not about getting over. It's not about forgetting. It's not about, well, they're over there in the cemetery, or they're just getting old over in a corner somewhere, and gee, thanks for your service. But what are the real costs when we go to war? Whether we think it's a good war or a bad war, the children, the kids, the young people who are called and who respond, whether from a draft or through what Karl Marx would call economic determinism, that is, as the economy tanks, you have plenty of people who are willing to man the tanks. What are those real costs? How do we deal with a moral calculus of what war means to human beings. And I think as a society, we largely don't. And this is not at all political. We, and I include myself, sit back, and the President of the United States at the moment, President Obama, moves 12,000 out of one country and 12,000 into another country. And the metaphor is that's often used is chess. They do this. We must do that. But they're not chess pieces. They're human beings. They're our children, our grandchildren, our cousins, our husbands, now our wives, who are called into war and into put themselves into, the euphemism is, into harm's way. The service is admirable, whether a good war or a bad war. Now, I know that this is a hard thing to deal with, but wars are fought and young people make their choices in real time. History can pull back and say, that was a terrible idea, that was imperial, that was folly, that was a mistake or a miscalculation. But in real time, people are called to respond to the need that's presented to them from their country, and they respond. Most, up until recently, in America, have been young. It's easier for young people to kill and for young people to die because they don't really deeply understand. They see the movies. An earlier generation heard the patriotic songs, and it seems glorious to march off on some holy quest, earlier holy crusade. We always cloak our killing in holiness on all sides. That's part of what makes it possible. The other part of what makes it possible is I remember talking to a psychiatrist friend of mine because I was consulting him about a loss that we'd had in the congregation and a young child who remained. And he said, well, John, do you know at what age children understand death? And I said, well, I know your answer. Your answer is 7 years old. My experience is we don't understand death at 7 or at 10 or at 18 or at 25. We all have different coping mechanisms of dealing with it, but the young people who say yes are not giving informed consent. They may be doing something that's brave, they may be doing something that's right or wrong, but it's not informed consent. There's a ritual as part of a traditional Jewish marriage ceremony, and you will forgive me for equating military service and marriage. The rate of being emotionally scarred is pretty similar for too many people. But there's a moment when this contract, the ketubah, is signed, and the rabbi says, now, do you understand everything that you have just signed? And to the wife, do you understand the commitment that you have just made? And the truth is, of course not. Life, marriage, war, death, all of these things are incomplete information problems that you bring goodwill and some information and some character to, but you can't really know what it is like to be in the trenches. You cannot know what seeing friends killed and sometimes mutilated will do to your heart and soul. And what those scars on your heart and soul, should you survive, will play out to others, to your family, to your friends, to your spouse, to your children, to your grandchildren. The cost of war is not dollars. It's much more than dollars. It's hearts, it's souls, it's lives. It's lives touched, many lives touched by one life in service, or one life lost, or one life scarred. It's not an individual decision. It's a communal part of who we are as a nation, and what every nation is. Because very few soldiers are enlisted, are drafted, are brought into service, believing that they're involved in something bad or awful or terrible. It is always sold, it is always presented as something admirable and patriotic. Everywhere. It's important to understand the extended human costs of war. It's important to remember the people who served, my friends who served in Vietnam, some who came back scarred and nearly broken, some who came back and didn't seem to be hugely affected by it. Human beings are different. But all of them were touched, and our society has been touched by every war, by every loss. And we are touched and we are changed when we avert our eyes and don't know what to say to the person who's been scarred. When we avert our eyes and don't welcome back the Vietnam veteran because we're embarrassed by a war, or we're embarrassed by a defeat, or we're embarrassed by a victory. The people who serve are not all heroes, and the people whom they fight are not all evil incarnate. They are used often like chess pieces on a board, but they are not chess pieces. They are not wood, they are not ivory, they are flesh and bone and blood and soul, and when we send them off to fight, these are children. We should have a good reason. We should have a clear vision, and we should have some small amount of humility and ability to see the humanity that is also on the other side. One of the ways that we go to war is by dehumanizing the adversary. So if ours are chess pieces, and that's kind of morally, ethically, spiritually neutral, the enemy is crazy, or they're vermin, or they're dogs, or they're pigs, but they are not humans. We won't use their names. We'll call them terrorists. We'll call them communists. We'll call them fascists. We'll call them dogs. We will not recognize that they are also children. When I was going through the cemetery at the Veterans Administration in Westwood, I remembered another cemetery. This one in North Africa when I was doing my Peace Corps service. I had visited some of the battlefields, and there were cemeteries, American cemeteries. At that point, the numbers of our losses were so great in World War II and also in World War I. I'm sure all of you have been to Europe. All of you who have been to Europe have seen the cemeteries, and our dead were too numerous to bring home. We bring them home now. But you go through those cemeteries, and again, you see the crosses, you see the stars, you see the people who are joined together, many of them so young. I was going through a cemetery in Tunisia, and it was a German cemetery. And in the German tradition now, and 40 years ago, they would put pictures on the tombstones. Now they have not only pictures, but they've gone several steps too far and put recordings and music in tombstones in Germany. I can kind of do without that, having the singing tombstone experience. It's a little startling. But to see the pictures, and raised as I was in a Jewish home, I never thought that I would weep at a German cemetery from World War II. These were children. These were young men moved by their society, moved by no other choice to fight and obviously to die for their country. It's important when we see troop movements, soldiers taken out of one country and put into another country, not to see them as chess pieces. There's a marvelous, terrifying scene in the film The Third Man that was shot in Vienna shortly after the Russians left and it was reunited. And the bad guy, Harry Lime, is up on the top of the Ferris wheel, the prodder, and he's talking to his friend, and he's looking down at those people who are down there. And his friend is accusing him of being a monster because he's sold stolen and diluted penicillin. And Harry Lime just says, "So what? Look down there at those people. They might as well be ants. Do you really have any concern if one of them should stop moving? What business is it of yours that one of them should stop moving?" Well, we see the monstrousness of that attitude in The Third Man with Harry Lime. It's important to see the monstrousness of the idea that our children, our grandchildren, our uncles and cousins and friends are chess pieces to be moved around. War may be a tragic necessity from time to time, but we must never lose sight of the humanity of those involved. We must never lose sight of our responsibility to those who have served, a responsibility and a promise that we made and largely kept up until recently to the World War II veterans, kept less well to the Korean veterans, kept nearly not at all to the Vietnam veterans. And government, Republican and Democrat alike, have failed in recent decades to keep promises that should be holy, sacred commitments to those who have answered yes with their lives, with their souls, with the scars and with the wounds and with the wisdom that they have acquired. World War II in the Pacific Theater ended effectively with the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It is almost miraculous that we have gone 60 years since the use of nuclear weapons. I think that one of the reasons is that it is still in living memory, that we still have veterans, we still have survivors. We all remember seeing the films and knowing about it, and the question is, will it be enough for future generations? Will it be enough in Eastern lands and in other countries that did not have the same educational experience or direct experience of nuclear warfare? This is where memory is important. Memory of those whom we have lost, memory of those who have served honorably and have passed away, memory of the human costs of war to ourselves and to adversaries, and memory serves peace. It's not simply Memorial Day is a great patriotic holiday, good for us. That's only part of it. It is an accounting of what war truly means. If we remember the cost, if we remember the sacrifice, if we remember the commitments, truly, those memories will serve as instruments of peace. We can take those instruments of battle, those swords and those, and pound them into plowshares, and to keep pounding them until they become instruments of music and instruments of peace. Cherish the memory, account the cost, and hold not simply in our hearts and our words, but make it happen in policy, that we treat our veterans well, not simply with a word, but with what our promises have been. They deserve it. They deserve it. Our society deserves it, and it will help serve peace.